This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Front Row. I'm Lee Chwee Lin. A couple of years ago, singer-songwriter and producer Pharrell Williams was caught in the crosshairs of a controversy when he was seen on the cover of LUK wearing a Native American headdress. Of course, he apologized for what might be considered a cultural appropriation of a sacred tradition. At the time, Simon Moya Smith, a Native American from the Oglala Lakota Nation and a journalist, wrote this: "The headdress is reserved for our revered elders who, through their selflessness and leadership, have earned the right to wear one. It's a spiritual garb, not just cultural. It's not merely an addition to one's attire. Wearing one, even an imitation headdress, belittles what our elders have spent a lifetime to earn." Today we're talking headdress, but they appear in works of art by Sivaraja Natarajan, a painter, photographer, sculptor, lighting and stage designer. And at some juncture, we're going to be asking him the question, is it okay to put on a headdress of another culture? I'm joined for this interview by Lim Soon Heng. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So you're the curator of exhibitions held at Sutra Gallery.
Yes.
And in this exhibition, what was that process like of curation? Because it's I imagine it would be different.
No, for me, I think like it's a part of it because I'm used to, you know, working with a lot of artists and all that. But this is my own work, my own exhibition. So I have my own freedom of, the artistic license. So I choose what I want to exhibit and want to share with the public. So for this, I focus more. I've been doing dance series, you know, for some time. And then for this, 2 years ago, I decided to work on, focus more on the headgears, you know, it comes from the different kind of a dance genres and all that. Throughout Southeast Asia, I can say like more like a Pan-Asia.
What kind of question did you start with asking? What kind of question did you ask yourself or pose for yourself to begin this exhibition?
Okay. For me, the concept, I didn't realize, you see, like I've been painting dance series for some time, you know, all kind of genres, you know, from the Malay traditional to Indonesian, Javanese, Indian, and all that.
You've never been painting performances?
Yeah, performances.
Which has got nothing to do with dances also.
Yeah, so I realized at one point, like, you know, unconsciously, I've been painting the characters with the headgears, you know, but for 2 years ago, then I decided that I wanted to focus only on the headgear, the upper torso and all that, you know. And then, I was more fascinated with the rituals, you know, behind putting up into the character of the, you know, when there's a ritual when you put up a headgear and all that. So I was fascinated with that. But that is very ritualistic. So I can't capture that, you know, the expression into my paint. But I just captured the glory of the headgear.
So then the approach here, you know, is it more sort of cultural interest or was it aesthetics? Because there are two things here. I mean, somebody could put on a Native American headdress, for example, thinking, oh, this is just so beautiful and not knowing, you know, all the ritual,
yes,
all the culture,
yes,
behind it. So for you in your art, what was of most interest, the aesthetic value or the cultural value?
Of course, there is also aesthetics and also the cultural value. Actually, we just touched on what the issue you brought up or the sensitivity of having in the traditional performance and theatres and all that, you know, the actors or the actors, they don't allow anyone to touch their headgears. And it is very personal. I think it's also very ritualistic, you know. They are very sensitive about this. I think people have to be sensitive. Even some audience or photographer want to go backstage and touch all this, I think they get offended, you know. So they don't allow. Because, like, they have all this bacha-bacha, you know, all these jumpies and all that, you know, to get in. So the moment they put the headgear, they take a different charm, a transformation, you know. You see the kind of a glow and all that. You see, before, even like if we talk about Jung and all that, the menorah and all that, before they wear the headgears, you know, they go, they have this kind of water, holy water, and then they just wipe on the face and then like they put some kind of bedak. And then they put it's like almost a different transformation.
I mean, I can see where you're going with this, in that, you know, with these traditional performances of dances in particular,
yeah,
there is an element of the divine involved. I mean, in some ways, actors, when they put on their makeup, I mean,
yes,
well, there's no sense of the divine. There is a transformation,
yes,
that we're talking about.
Okay. See, there is a ritualistic side of it and theatrical side of it. I think the ritualistic, there is a lot of sensitivities and do's and don'ts, the taboos and all that. But I think on the theater, I think it's like it's a character you're trying to portray. You know, you can wear anyone's headgears, you know, just to switch into the character. But I think in the theatrical world, I think the actor or the actress able to project that. You know, the moment they get into the headgears, you know, they wear someone's headgear, then they get into their character in action.
When it comes to the people who are going to be looking at these pieces, yeah. Because Sutra Gallery is so tightly knit to Sutra Dance Theatre,
yeah.
Are the people who are going to be seeing it sort of already skewed towards, I suppose, more artistic, more cultural sensibilities, yeah. as opposed to somebody who might be passing it by, you know, on a street side or okay. just encountering it not in this very specific sort of gallery setting?
But is it when you talk about Sutra galleries, and can you repeat the question? What is that?
Well, because of its, you know, sort of ties to, you know, gallery
performing
dance theater.
Okay,
exactly.
Yeah.
So the people who are likely to be passing through, the people who are likely to be seeing it,
yeah.
they might be people who are already sort of theatrical or
okay,
artistic
yes.
or culturally interested. Is it kind of skewed towards appealing to people who already have that existing set of interests, as opposed to somebody who might not understand, for example, the theatrical purpose of a headdress?
Okay. You see, we are open to the public, you know. You see, like Sutra Dance Theatre, we can look into our history since we started the gallery. We focus very much into the performing art genres and all that, you know. So everything is related to all the figurative, of course, and then it is very much related to the performance. You know, normally most of our collectors, the audience who comes in, is all related to the shows. You know, we always have performance, you know, in any of these dance venues and all that. We also curate an exhibition related to the particular productions. And then, of course, and then we'll bring the work back to the gallery and all that. So the audience can able to relate the characters comes out in the play or in the performance. And then can see the visual as well, you know, in the gallery, on the display. So in a way, it's all interlinked, you know. So the moment they come out, for example, you see a play on the performance on the theater, it just stays in the memory. But I think like we captured and freeze it on a canvas, and then it takes a different form, and people can own it by buying it.
See, for somebody who does not go to the dances or the performances in okay. Sutra, but they see these works of art, what kind of experience would it be for them?
Okay.
As opposed to those who are, in a sense, informed?
Okay. See, painting is an expression. It's very subjective. You know, someone might like it and someone don't like it, you know. But you see, we in our gallery, we see all sort of people are coming in and out and all that. I think they come with an open mind. They don't have anything fixed, you know. Like they come in like they just wanted to discover something. Okay, what is this all of us about this headgears and all that? Okay, I just wanted to see. People are very curious. You know, it's like I'm being, a Malaysian, Indian origin and all that. And then, like, why this guy is doing Chinese opera, Malay traditional dance? And is this guy a Malay or Chinese, that kind of thing? So I lost my identity there, you know. So I'm more a Malaysian. So, like, I tend to, you know, I wanted to share my experience, you know, with everyone, with the total Malaysians. So, like, people have to come. And whoever comes to the gallery, I think, like, they come with an open mind as well.
I mean, as a curator for many exhibitions that are yeah. over at Sutra House, like I said, like, you know, Lynn have just said, that the exhibitions tend to be tied in with performances.
Yes.
So people who come in who are familiar with Sutra House, they see this
yes.
in with a particular perspective. So for those who, like somebody who might not know who Sutra House
okay.
is or Sutra Dance Company more, yeah. more than Sutra House.
Never seen a dance.
Yeah, never seen yeah. an Indian dance. And they walk in. Do you, as a curator, when you are putting works of art there,
yeah.
think about them and say, okay, I must give them a different hook.
Well, basically what they do is, see, like when we host an exhibition and all that during the performance, see, they will go in and watch the show and then they will come out and then they're able to relate the movements or the characters into the display on the foyer or in the gallery. So in a way, they're able to relate that better. Rather than just putting in the memory, so once the artworks are there, and then this audience they're able to relate to that. Oh, I know these characters. This is Lapemidi de Yumphon. This is Nijinsky's character. This guy played. This is Sherazad. So this guy, the audience able to relate to that, and that will open up another kind of a thought. So they started collecting artwork. This is how we wanted to cultivate a new generation of collectors. You know, they are like just. Probably they are not a collect. They won't be collecting artwork at all. But probably if on that instant they decide to buy something, you know. So in a way, we are cultivating also the new generation, the younger generation of collectors, you know, to interest them.
For yourself, I mean, what is that process like for you of trying to set down motion into not motion? Because, you know, when you're trying to capture or,
yeah.
you know, sort of freeze frame something that is normally a dance, for example,
yes.
which is so embedded in the idea of not just the body, but of motion.
Movement.
What is that process like?
Okay, like if you look into my earlier works and all that, you can see, like, I try to capture the moving body, you know, you can say the moving spirit of the dancer. So almost like, you know, you take, you try to capture a dancer with a slow shutter speed, you know, with the, like, you know.
And everything's kind of a blur.
Yeah, so you can say almost like the moving, the blur image, you know. So that is like you're capturing the essence of the body, you know. But at one point, you know, then I've been doing all that since my college days and all. At one point, I said, like, you know, I want to, like, be very static, stark, you know, capture the, you know, to be very solid, you know. I don't know if it's an age factor or something, but at one point you tend to slow down, you know. So, like, you know, gone are the days, like, you express everything, you know, there's, like, anger, everything, you know. But at one point, I say, I want to take it subtly. I want to enjoy, you know, every single stroke which I do on my paintings, you know. So that's why by freezing it, you will enjoy, by layering the paint and all that, I think you'll enjoy that. It's almost like meditative.
In fact, the works in this collection, yes, in this exhibition, they look very, very static.
Static,
in the sense,
yes,
that as though they are holding themselves in position for you to paint them.
Yes. Of course. You know, like these are all like freezes, you know, from the characters which I freeze them. Because I want to capture that, you know, because, like, I don't want to create another. It's very easy for me to, like, you know, you just take another brush stroke and, you know, diffuse everything, then create a movement, you know, kind of almost like a wave movements and all that. But I think, like, by freezing them is more difficult, you know, because, you know, the anatomical proportions all have to be there. You know, it's easy if you express something, like, you know, on the emotion side of it. But I think, like, you know, if you want to freeze something, then your anatomical drawings and all that plays an important role.
We're speaking today with Sivarajan Natarajan, artist, sculptor, just all many, many hats. And hats, or headdresses rather, is also the topic of our show today. We continue the conversation after this. You are listening to Front Row on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You are listening to Front Row on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin, and together with Lim Soon Hing, we're speaking with Sivarajan Natarajan about his, well, work, The Crowning Glory, and work in general, really. But when it comes to The Crowning Glory in particular, we were talking about headdresses earlier.
Yes.
And your choice of headdresses have been quite interesting. There's, from what I understand, Indian, Indonesian, Javanese, but you also have Japanese and Chinese.
Yes.
How did you decide which ones you wanted to depict?
No, because for me, I think the when you talk about the crowning glory, I think I got carried away, fascinated with that, you know, the thing, you know, the crowning, the glory of the crown. So, like, of course...
Which is like your hair, is it?
Mine is just dreadlocks. In a way, I project that as well as one of, you know, but of course, for you, you know, the hair is also our crown, you know? So, like, that is another side of it when we talk about, you know, detail. But when we talk about the crowning glory, the theatrical crowns and all that, I think I was fascinated with the Indian folk theatres, you know, the street theatre, they call it Tirukuthu. In South India, in Madras and all that, you'll see that. It's almost like a propaganda theater. At the same time, they also carry out stories from the Ramayana and Mahabharata, the myth and mythologies and all that. So I was fascinated with certain characters, you know, in the Mahabharatas, for example, like the Karna, you know, the compassionate one, and then we have Yudhishthira and also the Bhishma, you know. So if you started reading about these characters, you know, then you will understand, you know, what is that crown meant to be, you know, and why is that, what is Bhishma is all about and all that, you know. So I was into fascinated, one of that. Another thing is like our local thing is like what we have, like a Matyung, menorah and all that. Of course, I'm exposed to this thanks to Ramli Ibrahim, who introduced me to the East Coast art forms and all that. So through our field trips and all that, I was exposed to the menorah, Matyung and all that in Tumpat, you know. So I able to see that during the ritualistic performance and all that. And then I started, developing an interest and then started painting and sketching them.
But traditionally, I mean, like his sutra, dance companies, it deals with either Indian, Javanese, kind of. But yeah, you have incorporated some Japanese and Chinese elements, which they are dances which I don't normally see over at,
okay,
sutra.
How, all right. See, yeah. Japanese, yeah, of course, the festivals and all that, we present, you know, a lot of Japanese, you know, from the No Theater or even, you know, the Japanese mass dancers. You know. We work with a lot of Japanese artists and also Korean and all that. So I think by interacting with them and all that, then of course they are also the traditional, you know, kabuki performers or, you know, or musicians and all that. So I get inspired by, you know, watching them rehearsals and all that. So that's where the Japanese and the Chinese, even the Chinese opera, I watch Chinese opera during the Hungry Ghost Festival. You know, there won't, no one will be sitting there. I'm the only one who will be sitting there. Then only I realized it's all for the spirits, you know. So, yeah, I didn't know that until my friend told me, you know. It's like, I was wondering why no one was sitting and watching the Chinese
opera. You took up one space.
Yeah, I took up one. So, they get offended.
Still talking about the Japanese and all that, because there's one particular piece that you have that's called Perfumed Garden. I don't know if you remember. There's one of an Indian traditional dancer, female.
Yes.
And next to her, you have this I think it's Japanese. So what were you exploring there?
It's a samurai. There's a samurai character. It's like inspired by the Japanese ukiyo woodblock print, you know. So I'm trying to superimpose this thing. You know, you see like this two, the Indian classical dance form is very colorful. Same as the Japanese samurai, you know. There's almost this vibrance of colors coming into this. I just want to put it side by side. It's just see what is that. There's no any logical reason or something. I just wanted to place it you're in terms of food, you just wanted to mix it. But, you know, then like in terms of it doesn't make any sense. But then I just want to experiment by putting the colors, and I wanted to see the harmony between the two different contrast culture.
Although, we've been talking about paintings and sketching and so on. But it's not just paintings and sketches that you have here. It's also sculptures,
right? I've done some bronze sculptures as well.
Okay. What is the process of getting that started? You know, how are you expressing crowning glory in the form of sculpture?
Okay. You see, this 2014, I was attending an art camp, a sculpture camp in Chennai, you know. And I was there. When I was involved in the art camp, then I have to work with these sculptors and all that. There are six of us. And we stayed in an art village. And then we started working on this sculpture. So each of us have to produce six pieces of sculptures and all that. And then that's my first attempt, you know, to make a bronze sculpture. See, the process is very traditional because I got no any background in sculptures and all that. Of course, like I'm very good in playing with clay and all that. Of course, when I get involved in that field, then I started taking the clay and started working with the subject which I'm most familiar with. For example, mask. You know, when you talk about this in Southeast Asia, we're exposed to all this kind of topengs and all that, you know, from Indonesia, orang asli and all that. So I started working on this, orang asli mask and all that. Then, of course, there is a... If you want me to explain the process, how we go through?
Sure.
See, basically, what happened? From the clay, you know, it's a very traditional method that they use. From the clay, then I'll do the face mask and everything. And then they will convert that into a plaster of Paris. You know, they'll take the mold out of that. Then they will destroy the clay. And then you already have the mold in the plaster of Paris. Then from there, we apply a layer of wax. Then you get a thin coating, almost like half an inch of wax thickness. And then you take out the plaster of it, then you already have a wax model of the whole thing, you know, almost 3D wax model, or the hollow wax model. And then on the top of this wax model, I will do all the detailings. So this is where the tedious process comes in. Because on the clay, you have a certain limitations. You know, suddenly it will break, and when, you know, the mold won't come out. But in the wax, you have the flexibilities and also the freedom. So the more you apply, I didn't realize, the more you apply the wax, the more heavier the bronze is going to take, you know. The more, in terms of load, if you put more wax, then the more heavier the bronze will be there, you know, because it's taking the volume.
Yeah, it follows the volume of the wax. Yes.
So I didn't realize this formula. So I was just enjoying putting everything. Then when after casting, I realized that my sculpture is very heavy. So that is like, you know, from the wax, then you cover up everything with a plaster of Paris, and then it almost comes like an eggshell. Then you put all these channelings, you know, you do the de-waxing. When you do de-waxing, it's like you channel out all this wax, you know, and then only these people will cast the bronze and pour it into that. See, that is a very traditional method, you know, because these people comes from Kumbakonam and all that, the South India. They make all these Indian, the Hindu statues and all this, you know, the gods and goddesses statues and all. So they are very traditional people. So they are very ritualistic. Even they wanted to start the fire also, they do a lot of rituals and all that. So one thing I realized, you know, whatever it is, I think on that time you have to be very calm. You shouldn't get so stressed out and all that. And then by pouring it, you never know until you break the mold. whether your sculpture has come out perfectly, or it's almost like giving birth to a newborn baby. You know, you never know until the baby comes out. So the same thing, like the wax, the molding process, and all that. So when the guy started melting the wax and pouring it, and then only he knows. Basically, he will tell you, "Okay, sir, your sculptures came out very well." I say, "How do you know?" I say, "Because the overflow was very good." But some of this process, what happened? There'll be fire coming out from another discharge flow. So that means there is a wax in it. Then it's burning. And then when you open up, then of course the sculpture is damaged.
How much control do you have in sculpting? I know, for instance, with photography, you have some control over it.
Yes.
But when it comes to, I don't know how much control you actually have even in photography. You take a picture and you can control in the printing process.
Yes.
And of course, with painting, you hold
control
the brush,
the stroke,
you control.
Yeah.
How much control do you have in making a bronze sculpture?
I think you can have your control if you have the foundation. You know, you can have, basically, I think like whatever you project, you do, mold is coming out. Nothing will go wrong. The only in terms of the technicalities of it, you know, the process, the melting and de-waxing it, you know, this is where the thing comes in. If the de-waxing the process doesn't go through well, then of course there is some blockage and your bronze won't get flow into that, then there'll be a hole in it. But I think like whatever you do, I think we take full control of it. You know, we cannot say this is an accidental effect. Yeah,
because I'm asking that question also in the context of when people, for instance, when they say oil, you have a lot of control. Watercolor, you don't have so much control.
Yeah.
So in the context of different genres of art, how much control is perceived as when you're doing sculptures?
I think sometimes, you know, when we paintings, you know, it's a different medium, you know.
Yeah.
Is it like water-based oil or dry mediums and all that you work? But for me, I think I have control of what I am in because, like, we learned the foundations, you know, in our college and all. We were taught, you know, understand the media. If you understand the material, then you understand the medium very well, I think you can have control of it. You see, like, there is no such thing as it just comes out accidentally, you know. Accidental effect is like, you know, we never expected an accidental effect. But you can use it as an excuse to please someone, you know, even if it is broken, you know. But I think, like, basically, there shouldn't be an accident. I think, like, you already know what you're going to project, you know, from your inner self. You know, I think whatever comes out is a reflection of yourself.
So that's where the technical skills come in.
Yes, but I'm more handicapped on the technical skill of it. So that's why I have to use the traditional caster to help me to do the casting. I will do all the finishing touch and all that in terms of more taking out the mold and all this, you know, it's a very technical thing. So that's what all the big foundries, they'll do, you know.
As an artist, what do you get out of working with both sculpture and painting? You know, Sunhing was asking about control.
Yeah.
But there's also the issue of, you know, what you want expressed, right?
Yeah.
What do you gain out of expression through paint that you don't get through sculpture and vice versa? What do you get out of sculpture?
Or through photography.
Okay. Yeah, exactly.
See, photography, those days when we were using films and all, you have to wait until you develop, you know, then only you see the effect. You know, most of it, half of it is already like underexposed or overexposed, you don't see the effect. But I think nowadays, the digital era, I think you get the result immediately, you know. But I think painting is like, you know, it's like, I think you have to build a relationship with the canvas. It's not that, you know, you can just, okay, I want to paint today. 2 hours, I want to finish. No, I think nothing will come out. I think you have to tame your muse. You know, it's like, you know, you can't simply order. I think that our muse, we can't tell ourselves, okay, I have a limited time. I want to paint something within this. I think nothing will come out. I think you. That's why you always have to be calm and relaxed when you do something. I think let it flow. You know, you sleep with the painting, you get up, then you paint again. The painting is never complete until someone bought it and leave your studio. That's it. Until then, you can just work. I've done a lot of works. I finished the painting 2 years ago. If it is in my painting, I put it on an easel. I still develop because I want. It's like a continuous journey. There's no end to it.
Finally, to close off, I mean, with all these different forms, I guess, in one gallery, what do you want the viewer to leave the gallery thinking and feeling?
Okay, see, my work is very much, you know, it's a theatrical genre, you know. We take it from all these dance forms and all that. I think people have to come in with an open mind and all that. I think they shouldn't, like, have a preconceived idea that this is how it's going to be, you know. But we are Malaysians and all that. We are multiracial and all that. So we know the rituals and do's and don'ts of other races, other religions and all that. Because I was exposed to all this environment and all that. And then I wanted to share, you know. I think the culture is like beyond all these things, you know, like when you talk about art and artists and all that, I think like they are different race, you know, there's only one race and they are, you cannot categorize them as a man, woman or Hindu, Muslim, Chinese. I think they are artistic community, you know, they are beyond all these race and religions and all that. I think we look at it as a culture and the aesthetic of it, you know, and something to preserve for ourselves. Of course, to please your alter ego, definitely. And then I think it's something like you wanted to present it, you know? You want to, like, save it for the future.
Art will save us.
Say again?
Art will save us.
Definitely, definitely.
The Crowning Glory is an exhibition of paintings and sculptures by Sivaraja Natarajan. This exhibition will run till July 25th at Sutra Gallery. Gallery hours are 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday to Friday, and from 10 a.m. to just a little past noon at about 12:30 p.m. on Saturday. It is closed on Sundays and public holidays. Admission is free. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you so much, Lynn. Thank you, Sneheng. Thank you.
We've been talking to Sivaraja Natarajan. You've been listening to Front Row today on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.